Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show, where we help you win at the game of business and marketing so you thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. As the name says, our listeners like you are business creators. We have our entrepreneurs, small business owners, local business owners. We have the marketing and business coaches and consultants and mentors. We have the folks who help others create their businesses. And on the other side of that same coin, the do-it-yourselfers like to have your own hands on the levers. If you are one or more of the above, and many of our listeners like me are all of the above, take a moment, explore our episodes, discover how we serve you at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. Also, be sure to check us out on networks such as iTunes. Be sure to subscribe. You'll get fresh content every single week and immediate access to over 260 episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to business creators just like you. So here's what we're finding in our fast-moving economy and the evolution of the environment of business is some organizations can shift ahead to stay relevant, and others can't. So we're going to take some time today, and we're going to dissect that, and we're going to look into some of the reasons why this happens, why it seems that some organizations have that relevancy factor and others kind of get left behind. And we can think in the news of some examples of companies that got left behind or some that have been able to adapt with the times. So we're going to do some case studies. We're going to look at some examples of how some of this works. We're going to look at some actual leaders and how they dealt with the environment of business. And to walk us through that, I'm very happy to have with us today a gentleman named Alan Adamson, which is one I definitely should know because my name is Adam. So Alan Adamson, who has a very exciting book out called Shift Ahead, How the Best Companies Stay Relevant in the Fast-Changing World, is somebody who you definitely are going to want to enjoy listening to today. And just to tell you a little bit about Alan Adamson, oh my goodness gracious. You know what else is funny? When I was in college, my nickname was Big Al because my signature at the time looked like the word Alan. So Alan Adamson is a noted industry expert in all disciplines of branding. He is the co-founder and managing partner of Metaforce.co and the author of Brand Simple, Brand Digital, The Edge, 50 Tips from Brands That Lead, and of course, Shift Ahead, How the Best Companies Stay Relevant in a Fast-Changing World. Prior to Metaforce, Alan was chairman, North America, of Landor Associates, which is a global branding firm that some of us have, in fact, heard of. So, Alan Adamson, come on in. The weather's fine.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for inviting me, and it was easy for me to get your name right.
That's okay.
Lots of people call me Alan Adamson, Adam Allenson, so you join the crowd.
Oh, I mean, my last name is Homey. You know how many people have butchered that or used it for fun?
Yeah, I'm sure you had a tough time in high school with that.
Well, see, now you're dating me, but you're doing so accurately. That show, In Living Color, came out when I was in middle school. Now, if I had had more of a sense of humor, my life might have been a little bit different.
Exactly.
And you want to hear one other irony? Back in those days, everybody could get my name right. Even complete strangers would just walk up to me, and they always got my name right. But here in 2018, you know, near the end of the second decade of the 21st century, when that television show is well nigh 30 years behind us,
You know how badly that
name gets butchered these days? I mean, I had somebody manage – I mean, it's a six-letter last name, and I had somebody manage to make three mistakes with it.
Oh, better than four, I guess.
I guess so. So let's so before we get into the core of what we're going to cover today, and I am very excited about this Shift Ahead concept. I've had an opportunity to look into it, and I see some of the stuff you want to share with us today. It's going to be very exciting and very revelational. Let's take a step back, Alan, and just tell us a little bit about your journey, what's brought you through your career, your business, your entrepreneurship, even something that's driven you personally, and what's brought you to where you are today serving business creators in the intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Well, I started off, no one grows up to go into business consulting or brand consulting. I started off always
right.
going to be a filmmaker, and funny thing happened. Lots of producers in Hollywood didn't call me up and say, here's a big job. So I went back to school, did a little bit more, and then I made small films. Not really made them, but I went into the advertising business. If your listeners ever watched Mad Men, it was not quite that far back and not quite like it was portrayed in Mad Men, but we had to figure out how to tell a story in 30 seconds, and sometimes you actually got to film it. Did that for a while, and then I went to do marketing at what they call the consumer goods companies. I worked on bar soaps and detergents and dishwashing liquids, which don't sound too exciting, and in fact they're not, but they're good ways to learn marketing, because the difference, I should not say this publicly, but between one soap and the next is not that big, and so why you choose one or the other is driven lots by marketing and less by how well they clean. And after doing that for a bit, ended up in brand consulting at Landor and had a great time because it got me working across many categories, B2B, big companies, small companies, nonprofits, and you know, when you get the chance to work across many industries, you learn a few things from each of them you work at.
Right. And I think it's very true. So, let's take another step back and let's start from the beginning of this Shift Ahead thing. You created this great book, which is called Shift Ahead, How the Best Companies Stay Relevant in the Fast-Changing World. So what drove you to write that book?
It was over time we began to encounter more and more clients and say, can you help me on marketing? We're not selling enough. Our sales are falling. Can you help me get more famous? And people aren't buying us as much. And many, many times it wasn't a question of marketing. It wasn't a question of not having the right ads or the right promotions or the right logos or the right social media. It was their business was irrelevant. They were becoming their father's automobile. And, you know, no amount of marketing could make somebody want your father's automobile. And so as the number of people ringing a doorbell saying, help me, my sales are falling, it became clear that, was it my imagination? Or was it more and more companies were having trouble keeping up and were falling behind? So that caused me to say, let me take a break. I partnered with a professor from NYU, and we ended up doing a lot of research. We spoke to lots of companies, looked at lots of organizations, and found out that, more and more companies are ending up in the headlines you read every day, whether it's Sears going bankrupt or Barnes & Noble struggling to stay in business or P&G cutting its workforce or, dozens and dozens of headlines every day about companies that were once king of the hill, which were no longer king of the hill.
Yeah, you know.
And I wanted to, find out what was it my imagination? What was causing it? Why? Everyone knows you need to change to stay relevant. You don't have to be a genius to know that if you do the same thing for 100 years, it's unlikely you'll be as popular today as you were 100 years ago. But so everyone knows you need to change to stay current and fresh, but why, if everyone knows it, do so many people struggle at doing it?
Yeah, that's very interesting to think about. And I'll tell you, in my work, the moment I hear somebody say, well, that's the way we've always done it, I think, oh, no. Because when I hear that phrase, what crosses my mind is, yeah, and somehow you still managed to be here even though you did it that way yesterday.
Exactly. And sometimes you've been around a long time is an important signal of trust. You trust companies that have been in business a long time, and that's important, but not as important as perhaps it used to be, and not a reason. The only reason you get to get people to buy your products, I just without picking on somebody right now, but recently Ford just launched a new campaign, and I love the ad with Bryan Cranston, but they just talk about how they've been building real cars for 115 years, and that's interesting. But if I go to the showroom and I don't find anything I like, the fact that they, were building it since the Model T, probably not going to get me to buy one.
Right. Very true. Very true. So what are some – let's kind of dive in here. And what are some ways, since we're talking about relevance, that one can keep their business relevant in this ever-fast-changing world where it seems like things are just speeding up?
First I think, your listeners need to realize that the tide's swimming against them. They just have to realize that there's some things that make changing hard and keeping up hard. And one of them is most of us are like Marty Crane on the old TV show Frasier. I don't know if you recall or your listeners recall, you know, he had his old chair in Fraser's apartment. And that's because the familiar is more comfortable. People are just generally more comfortable doing what they did yesterday than changing. And, you know, it seems obvious, but most, you know, you have to remember that, if be self-aware that if you're aware that you're going to go to the office and do what you did yesterday, and you're more likely to do that than do something different, you realize you're starting in the end zone. And so part of it is looking inside and saying, gee, if I do the same thing every day of the year, and I've done the same thing for 10 years, I wonder what that may be about, and I need to get comfortable trying something new, or I may end up, you know, being like Marty Frazier.
Right. Very true. Very true. So, go ahead.
No. And so that's a good place to start. And there are a lot of other, you know, constraints that make it hard to change just before you even get into anything else. And the other one is most public companies have what we found out to be some, you know, like golden handcuffs. There's a huge pressure, if you follow the business world, of, you know, delivering for today, making your numbers this quarter. And as such, it's really hard if you're in a big company to make a long-term bet. So, you know, besides Marty Crane's chairs, most of people in corporate America are wearing golden handcuffs, or wearing handcuffs that prevent you to succeed. And the third thing is that, you know, by the time many, many people decide, oh, I better change, it's often too late. They've run out of money. You know, three of their competitors have beaten them. By the time Barnes & Noble realized Amazon was going to be a problem, Barnes & Noble, you know, saw them coming. They looked at their business. They could have bought Amazon. But they decided, who's going to buy books online? But by the time they decided, oh, my goodness, we need to do something, you know, their business was free-falling, and it was too late. There was no fuel left in the tank.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So what does it take? Because we're looking at the companies as a whole, but now let's look at the individuals. So what would it take for some individuals in the organizations, as well as the organizations themselves, to embrace this idea of relevancy, to stay relevant in such a fast-changing business environment?
Well, one of the things we also found that, you know, when you talk about the individual, most people are very fixated on what's happening right in front of their nose, or most people are very fixated on what's happening with their direct competitors. So if you have a store on one corner, you're looking across at the other guy across the street, and what are they doing? And if when I was at Unilever, I was very worried about what P&G was doing and what Colgate was doing. When I worked with Pepsi, I was very focused on what Coke was doing and why is Coke doing this and we should do that. And most people, you know, are very, very good at paying attention to what's right in front of them. And that's important because, you know, understanding who your competition is and why, you know, what they're doing right is important. But we refer to it more like, you know, a lot of people are playing a lot of tennis. And in tennis, which I play badly, you have to really pay attention to your opponent. You have to try to hit the ball when they're not. You have to, you know. But
yeah.
One of the things we found that was a successful tool for individuals is play a little less tennis and play a little more golf. Look back, look at the ball, see what the environment looks around, look at the wind, look at the terrain. Because oftentimes change in your business does not come from if you've got a dry cleaning store, from the dry cleaning store down the block. You know, disruption does not come from direct competitors. If you look what's happening in the marketplace, if you look at almost any company that's having trouble, Gillette has run into trouble, and for years they were just focused on why their razor was better than Schick, and if we had four blades, Schick had four blades, and Schick said five blades, and Gillette said five blades, and they were really focused on, you know, how do you beat the direct competitor, and of course they weren't paying attention off to the side when Harry's came in or other direct business models, and they've got their clock clean. So lots of companies stay very focused on their direct competitor, and don't pay attention to the peripheral, to zoom out a bit. Look around them as if they're playing golf versus intensely focusing on the business right in front of their nose from their competitor.
Yeah. You know what's funny is you mentioned that about the number of blades in the razor blade or what have you. Is just as I was thinking of that, I went to my computer and I was reminded of an article that came out on The Onion, which is a satirical site, 14 years ago at this point. I didn't realize it was that long. And the title of it is, you'll get what the first word is, but it's F everything, we're doing five blades. And it's supposedly from the CEO of the Gillette company saying that, you know, basically we're going to five blades. Some people are doing three, some people are doing four, and some people are doing five. And you know what? I mean, we may be at a point. I'd have to look in the store, but we might be actually getting close to eight blades at this point.
Right. And everyone was, you know, thinking that was the game. You know, if the competitor had six blades, let's go to six. They go to seven. But, you know, to some extent, that's important because if you didn't offer that, you were going to lose some market share. But what changed was somebody said, well, maybe blades aren't that important. Maybe if I just mail everyone a razor when theirs wear out and I do it for less price, that will be more important than the number of blades. So, you know, while it's always start, you know, you look at any business school class, you know, look at your competition, analyze their strengths and weaknesses. That's still important. But if you get too fixated on it, you can get disrupted and somebody else is going to shift ahead of you.
And see, you bring up something right there. I think you're referring to the Dollar Shave Club where they will mail you updated blades and shaving cream and everything every month. And you know, another market that's out there that I think we're going to see more and more of, I'm predicting this right now, is, you know, those disposable blades actually have a usable life of up to 5 years if you take care of them.
Doesn't surprise me, but I didn't know that, but thanks Adam for sharing that. So people
it's
are going to
very true. Yeah. Very true. If and there are articles to teach you how to use denim to clean out the blades, and there are articles to teach you how to properly use a toothbrush to clean out the blades without slicing up the toothbrush. But my prediction is somebody's going to come out with something that's going to enable you to clean your blades so that they're sharp for years to come. I personally know how to do this. I use disposable blades, but I've been using the same five blades in rotation for about 3 years now. It's just, I just look at it as, aside from the fact that, you know, saving me $20 a month, in essence, which is money well saved, that it's also good for the environment because otherwise I'm throwing away a bunch of perfectly good razor blades, and that's just silly. So I have a system for doing it, and maybe I could market that system, or maybe somebody else will come along. That's my prediction.
Exactly. So instead of asking, if you ask a consumer what's most important on a razor blade today, they'll say, you know, four or five blades, and it has to be sharp, and you have to replace it every month, and it has to get a good price.
Yeah.
But if you zoom out a bit and say, you know, what's really important, you're going to get a bunch of consumers saying, well, I don't want to, you just said waste money, or I don't want to, I want to do what's socially responsible. You know, we've got enough landfill, you know, we need to be more concerned with our environment. And all of a sudden, if there's a razor blade that self-sharpens and is, you know, lasts for 5 years and is good for the environment, well, you know, gee, I don't care how many blades the other guy has. You know, I want to go that direction.
Yeah, very true. So that's my prediction, is we're going to see something hit the market in a big way that's about how to clean and preserve your existing disposable razor blades. That's my prediction.
Right. Yep.
So
and that's enough. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Alan. Go ahead.
That's another, you know, besides paying too much attention to their competition and, you know, only doing, you know, following, just matching them and playing that five blade, four blade, three blade, eight blade. You know, lots of people get a really fixed worldview. They look at the world and say, this is the way it is and this is reality. And they run everything based on their sense of what the world is. And we had a great conversation with the folks at National Geographic, a publication that I grew up with. And, you know, they viewed their mission as, you know, to increase and, spread geographic knowledge. And they viewed their world as, you know, our job is to, you know, capture this and to produce a magazine. And that's the business we're in. And despite that, and they had a huge lead since 18, and one of those been around for a long time. They almost didn't make it because their view was so fixed on they were in the magazine business they didn't think of what they're really doing is maybe a little different. And they almost disappeared, but they ended up doing a couple smart things to reimagine. It's, you know, a very famous idea that they weren't myopic. They zoomed out a bit to say, you know, we could do a magazine, but what are we really about? And what they really were about was understanding nature and appreciating nature and the environment. And they figured that out just in time to reinvent their business in many ways that makes them very relevant and powerful today.
Yeah, you can still go to the store and buy a National Geographic magazine. I go to Whole Foods. I see a Nat Geo in the rack almost every time I'm there. But when I think of Nat Geo realistically today, I think of either, remember they used to say National Geographic, and you just heard me say Nat Geo, because they've done such a great job of making you think of Nat Geo, which is their TV network.
Right, TV, and they also did a joint venture with a cruise line. So now if you are lucky enough, you can get on a National Geographic boat and go up to Alaska and, have a National Geographic photographer help you take the incredible picture of the whale breaching, whether you're using, your phone or whether you're using a camera. You can go on hikes and look at the bears feasting off the salmon, and somebody from National Geographic will explain, the biodiversity of the area. And so it's educational. So they've taken that from the magazine and let you become your own National Geographic explorer. And, of course, when you're out there, snapping pictures of your iPhone of incredible whales breaching in front of you, what do? You put it on social media, and all of a sudden everyone's social media is filled with, no one's going to say, I did something really exciting, Adam. I read a magazine. But, if you've got an incredible picture of the whale, you're going to say, hey, look at this great picture I took out in Alaska. I did it with the help of a National Geographic photographer who got my finger in front of the lens and took it away. Whatever they did to make you get the perfect picture, and you're going to share it, and it becomes an experience you can share. So they were able to zoom out in time to save the brand from a fixed worldview.
Exactly, and I think that's great. So National Geographic is one great example. And let's look at a few other companies. I know you, throughout some of your interviews and your books, you mentioned companies like Kodak, Marriott, Toys R Us, which has been very much in the news, and Xerox. And just, from an overview view, what are some of the things, Alan, that they did right, and what are some of the things they did wrong?
Well, one of the things, we went back and did a lot of research into, Kodak used to be king of the hill for your listeners old enough to remember. They owned photography, and all of a sudden their cheese moved. And they, I always thought that they just didn't see the digital revolution coming. They were just happily making film and selling it around the world. And to our surprise, when we did the research, we found out that, they had some really good market forecasters. And they knew almost to the month, years in advance, there would be this day in time, 5 years from now, when film wouldn't be the way people take pictures anymore. So they knew this train was coming down the track right at them. And I said, well, that's even worse. Couldn't they get out of the way? Didn't plenty of time. They had lots of money. And what happened? And, a piece of it was, of course, it's never just one thing that takes a company from top of the hill to almost out of business. It's many things.
Right.
But in this case, their culture, their strength was in the marketing and sales. They were a chemical company because film was a chemical process. And even though they had lots of digital technology, their culture, their natural strength, their DNA, as we say, was more of a chemical company. And so they had a decision. They had some chemical companies they owned. They owned some pharma companies. And they finally said, we're going to go digital. We're going to sell all those companies that made chemical things from aspirins to raw chemicals, and we're going to go digital. But their core DNA was still a chemical company. So it's sort of like, I could take basketball lessons and I could learn all the techniques by watching lots of videos. But at, 5'9", I'm not going to be a good basketball player. So, companies need to play to what their strengths are. Even if you know you have to become something else, you have to have the DNA and the strength. So one is, just knowing what's coming is not enough. If you need to make that big a shift, and there are many, many other examples of companies that tried to do that, you need to make sure to either find people that know how to do that or, go to basketball camp and really learn and try your best, because just saying you want to be in a different business doesn't mean you'll be successful.
Right.
So that's, you know, that was an interesting thing about Kodak. Another thing that happened that, you know, that lots of people fall to that reminds me of Kodak was, you know, there's often when you're very successful, you get very arrogant. You believe you're the best. You know, we know what we're doing. We're great. And we had some interesting conversations with people who worked at BlackBerry many years ago. And if you're, again, your listeners think back, BlackBerry used to be the way lots of people in business communicated. Everyone had a BlackBerry in business because it had a keyboard and you could send emails with it. And people were saying, that's the way I communicate. When we said, didn't you see the change coming? And they said, no, we asked consumers what they wanted, and they said they liked their keyboard and they liked their BlackBerry. And we looked at that music player that was being launched by this firm in Cupertino, and they'll say, no one's going to give up their real business tool, but you know, that's a toy. No one's going to be, you know. So they were arrogant. They didn't think, you know, iPhones would be real. Same with Nokia, who owned the phone business. And they were going out and doing research, and they had the huge cell phone decision. And they say, would you pay $300 for a cell phone? And people say, no, I'll pay $59. And so they got arrogant. And no one's going to pay that much money for that. And, of course, they were asking the wrong questions, as we should know in hindsight. And, of course, people would pay, you know, more than $59 if they had a handheld computer versus a place to make phone calls. So, you know, arrogance and, you know, and being, you know, not really believing that, you know, the change could be coming is another reason lots of companies end up like Toys R Us or BlackBerry.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember when I first started having cell phones. Boy, it seemed like for the first 5 years I had a cellular, the only option really out there was Nokia. Like,
yep.
I mean, I know there are other brands out there, but that's what maybe it's because I just hooked onto Nokia and I like the type of phones they have. But when I think about it, almost everybody I knew had a Nokia.
Yep.
They owned it. And then there we go. And so tell us about Toys R Us. You know, they've been in the news lately.
Yeah, tough times right now. You know, they ran into yet another, again, as I said, it's never just one thing. If it were one thing, most people could say, oh, let's not do that. But the Toys R Us, you know, there were many things going on at Toys R Us, but one of the challenges they had was that inside they couldn't decide which way to go. They knew they had to beat Amazon or Walmart on price, so they had lots of their stores set up to try to win on price, which the toys piled to the ceiling and, you know, just, you know, buy one, get one free, and they were really trying to compete on the price front. But there also was a group of people, and the people in the management said that we need to do a high-end experience. And so they had some flagship stores like the one in Times Square and high-end stores where you could actually go in and ask somebody, look, you know, I have a 9-year-old, what do you recommend? And they knew the toy category. They would take you around. They would explain things. And so half the company wanted to go super high-end. Half the company wanted to try to win the price war. And they got into what's often called, you know, analysis paralysis. You know, we'll do both. We are not sure. And unfortunately, if you try to do two things, you end up often being okay at both but not great at one. So they and while they were trying to figure out which way to go, high-end, really good customer care, or, you know, try to out Amazon or out Walmart, they got run over. They got run over on both sides by small little toy stores that, you know, survived on Main Street to give a customer an intimate thing, or the other marketers, whether it's Target or anyone else getting back into the toy business. And of course, they got run over by Amazon, who continues to make most retailers challenging. And to this day, you know, there's probably a business need for a toy store. And Toys R Us is probably the brand most people recognize. But just having awareness, just being saying, oh, I've heard of that brand, that's the other thing. You know, lots of people say, oh, if I just had some awareness, if people could only, you know, remember my name, I'd be okay. And yes, that's important. But if people only remember your name, but they don't think you're different in a way they care about, all that name awareness doesn't mean much of anything.
Wow. See, that's something. And, you know, this brings up a related question. You mentioned Amazon, and you mentioned other online retailers and the impact they're having on bricks-and-mortar retailers, which is very much, when we think of Toys R Us, we think of, hey, let's go to the toy store and let's play with the toys and then buy some. And we see all these online retailers and what they're doing to bricks and mortar, what they're doing to shopping malls, for instance. Now,
yep.
I'm going to speak for myself personally, and I may not speak for everyone, but I speak for me, is if I'm going to buy, let's say, for example, clothing, I don't want to, you know, guess my size and then, you know, order something and, you know, say I want it in this size and then have to get it in the mail and try it on. And even though maybe it's my size, you know, the cut of it or the style of it just doesn't flatter me. And then I have to send it back. I don't want to go through three rounds of exchange to get the suit I want. I don't want to go through two rounds of exchange to get the jeans I want. I want to try them on and get the pair I want, walk out with them and be done with it. Do you think that there's going to be room in the marketplace for bricks and mortar retail?
You know, I think there definitely will be room, although I think it's going to vary by category. You know, you may do that for jeans, but if you want to buy batteries, you probably don't need to go to the store to pick up the batteries and see if they're shiny silver or shiny gold. So, and I think the nature of retail, because, you know, ironically, as I'm sure your listeners know, Amazon is getting into retail. There are more and more Amazon stores popping up. And there are a couple of different concepts they're testing, not only, you know, Amazon bookstores, but Amazon stores that just stock the most popular items on Amazon. So if you want to see the top 50 trending items, you can go in the store and actually experience it. So I think the retail will have to change, or it is already changing. It'll probably need to change more. And it will have to change by category, and it will probably change to be more experiential. So if you end up going into an Amazon bookstore, you know, you probably don't want books piled to the ceiling, and, you know, you're not going there to get the cheapest price. You're going there to browse, to maybe talk to someone who can tell you, you know, what do you recommend in a good thing, or you to touch and feel. You're going there for the cappuccino, maybe, but not for, you know, can I get this book for $6.99?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, a book is pretty much a book. So yeah. I appreciate you taking the time to bifurcate this and give us a level of understanding. I mean, what I'm just saying is I really hope we don't get to a situation where we can't go to a clothing store and try on clothes, because I'm not going to be very happy in that case.
Yeah, I don't think we're heading totally to that. But unfortunately, if you go to, as you know, if you go down the main street or go to a mall, not every store is a clothing store, so, you know, there's still going to be a lot of challenges for many, many of the other retailers. But, you know, I just think you have to not just look at what your other retailers are doing, but you have to zoom out and say, you know, how can I reimagine my business in a way that's relevant today?
Right.
Which is easier said than done. You know, part of another successful criteria that if you look at people that tend to be better at shifting ahead and those that struggle with it is the ability to, you know, to sometimes, you know, get away from their desk and look outside and look at the marketplace and get out of, as the phrase goes, get out of their bubble. So not just go, you know, to your same coffee shop, the same bookstore, the same grocery store every day, but to get out of your neighborhood, to look what's going around, you know, to start zooming out a bit. Because change doesn't, as I said earlier, happen often right in front of your nose. And to see it, you have to look for it.
True. So inside your book, Alan, you mentioned leaders such as John Sexton of NYU, and Bill Marriott. What is it that brought you to include those in the Shift Ahead book, and what can we learn from them?
You know, we spoke to lots of leaders, and in general, you know, the ones that do well are pretty clear. What I was looking for was stories for that were a little different. But you know, Bill Marriott and the Marriott organization, you know, they're pretty, even though their market is also changing, and you can say, well, it's the difference in hotels. You know, one hotel's like the next, and you know that is a challenge because it used to be people wanted a homogenous experience. You wanted to wake up in Kansas and then wake up in St. Louis and not feel like any different. Now everyone wants to go to a hotel which has a unique experience. So that's changing. But you know, one of the phrases that was often used to describe Bill Marriott, tying back to the point I was talking about earlier, was they said that Bill Marriott's feet never touched his desk. He was always out in the hotels, always out talking to customers, always out talking to their front desk people. How are we doing? What's going on? So, you know, part of his leadership style was not to be in an office, in a conference room, reading numbers, but was to go out and see what was going on. You know, he had a bit of what's called a founder's mentality, because he was a founder. Oh, and a founder mentality, when you start a business, you're always, you know, worried that are people going to buy it? Are they going to like this, you know, tuna fish? Or not going to like this tuna fish? Are they going to like the food in my restaurant? So Bill Marriott never lost this sense of, you know, getting out and talking and listening and seeing the fringes and talking to their customers. And so that's one characteristic of a strong leader. Another characteristic we found, and I'll come back to the NYU question in a second, is that typically when you're going back to Toys R Us, you know, they couldn't decide if they wanted to be a high-end, intimate toy experience or a cheap one. The answer, which way to go, is it's never obvious. You know, often both roads look cloudy and bumpy.
Yeah.
And so sometimes a leader has to say, look, you know, I think this is where we're going to go, and here's what we're going to do. And if they start early enough and they execute well against, they're better off than trying to figure out the answer. Because by the time the answer becomes certain, everyone sees it, and then it may be too late. So another characteristic was the ability to trust their instincts or trust their judgment and make a decision and not say, well, let's put it under committee and study it some more, or let's field another research study. leaders that, you know, because, you know, there's a bit, it's risky, and you need to be, you know, comfortable under risk. One of the leaders I spoke to was Ed Vick, who ran a big ad agency, and I said, yeah, so, you know, what did you do to shift their business ahead? He said, well, yeah, I was in the military when I was a young kid, and I was on a boat being shot at. And, you know, that's life and death. And whether we make our quarter or miss our quarter, you know, no one's going to, yeah, it's going to be, I want to do well, but it's not a life and death decision. So when you're in the military, you learn how to make life and death decisions, and you tend to be more risk comfortable. You say, let's close this door, let's move on. And he said that was, you know, part of my to be cool under fire was another way he phrased it. So I think, you know, those are other criteria. And the final one I'll just close with is that if you have a leader who knows where they want to go and is cool under fire, they need to be able to communicate that and tell the people on their team, we're going to go this way or we're going to go that way. Because, you know, if you're lost in the woods and somebody says, let's go this way, you might say, well, I don't know, John. You know, and so if people aren't sure, it won't be clear that's the right way to go until way down the road. So a good leader needs to be able to explain why he wants to go to the, or she wants to go to the road on the left. And if she says the left is the right way to go, she has to, or he has to be able to, you know, quickly articulate their vision. And so with NYU, the president of NYU at that point had to reinvent NYU, and he had a vision for what a university and his ideas for what NYU had to become. And his view was, rather than build walls around this NYU campus and make a traditional campus at NYU, NYU needed to be what he called in and of the city. It needed to integrate with New York City. It had to be totally woven together so they wouldn't be a grassy campus and you build high walls. And that led to his philosophy about embracing everything about New York and making New York part of the educational experience, which ultimately helped New York NYU become a stronger school. But that was not widely shared among the people who the professors and the academic people at NYU, but he had incredible what I'll call storytelling ability. He could spend 20 minutes with you and explain why embracing New York City at a time New York City was not not much to be embraced, why that was the right way to go. And so a good leader needs to be able to get people to come with them on their journey.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because a lot of times when we do think of universities, for instance, we do think that they are behind walls. I went to Penn State myself, and the main campus, I don't want to say it's exactly integrated with the borough of State College, but it's not like Penn State is behind this big wall. And what's also been very interesting about Penn State, especially over the past 20 years since I graduated, is the physical growth of the campus outward into the borough, because they simply ran out of room on a campus.
Right.
So they've now been going to external locations and creating these buildings. So the integration is happening regardless.
Right. But the key is for the leader and to shift, you have to say, you're going to always be facing, if you're running a deli or a dry cleaner or you're building, you're always going to have a fork in the road. You're always going to have a couple choices. And, you know, there's never going to be obvious which way to go, but, you know, one of the characteristics of leaders that help companies shift ahead is they decide which way to go, and they can tell a story that makes that future clear when it's foggy. People can't see around the corner. They can't see. And they tell the story well enough that people say, yeah, you know what, let's go down that. I know it's going to be rainy. I know it's going to be windy. It's going to be cold, and we're all going to starve. But, you know, I believe you. If you can't get the organization to just lean into that direction, then you end up saying, well, we'll do a little of one, we'll do a little of two, we'll do a little of three, and we'll see what happens, we'll study it. And oftentimes, if you do many things, you tend not to be as good as if you do one thing. And the other, of course, big thing that separates winners from losers is companies that shift ahead, you know, just tend to be great at execution. And you look at, everyone talks about Apple a lot. They weren't the first one to do the, you know, the iPad. There were lots of tablets. They were the first one to get it right from, you know, the product design to the user interface to, you know, so, you know, being first is often helpful, but being the best or getting it right usually leads to companies shifting ahead more than just we'll do a little of everything and see which one wins.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, the thing that we also discover is we like to, not we, you know, but as a society, let's just say in general, folks will have a tendency to look at big companies and make mistakes and say, ah, ha, 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 look at them, bunch of incompetent losers. Like when you had the Samsung phones a couple years ago that were having the issues with the batteries exploding, and like, ah, ha, ha, and it's fairly well known, because here we are, it's 2018, and I still use my 2014 Samsung Galaxy Note 3.
Yep.
You heard that right. We're on, what, about the Note 9X or something like that at this point, if you were to go buy a new one. Here's what I do, is I buy state-of-the-art whenever I buy electronics. Like, whatever's the ultimate state-of-the-art at that time, that's what I buy. And then I sort of have a competition to see how long I can keep it going.
Yep.
That's me. So, naturally, every time that I mention anything about the Samsung Galaxy Note, like the 9 was having the batteries exploding, or my power cord frayed because the thing was 4 years old and the cord just got old from use, and people say, ah, it's because you use one of those stupid Samsungs. Look at those morons. Okay, what am I going to do? Go run out and get an iPhone? I don't think so. It's not going to work that way. But but unfortunately, you know, we see folks that love to see forward-moving companies, forward-moving organizations, those that do the one thing that make it happen, and put that down. And why do they do that?
Well, I also think that, you know, oftentimes, you know, Samsung is a winner in the marketplace, even though they had a tough couple of years. And they're a winner because, you know, with the realization that for most companies, shifting ahead means you're going to stub your toe. You're going to try something. It's not going to work. If you're going to keep inventing yourself and try new things, you're going to make mistakes. And companies that tend to have the courage to make mistakes, or make mistakes because they, move too fast or just make mistakes. But the most important skill in shifting ahead is resiliency. Can they pick themselves up, figure out what was wrong, fix it, and make it right for the customer? And I think that was the case of Samsung. You know, they had a problem, but they recalled almost all the phones. They made good on their promise. You know, it was an expensive, painful year, but they realized that if they let their customers down and just said, "Ah, sorry, it didn't work out. Go buy yourself a competitor phone," they would, and they'd never come back. So I think, you know, part of successfully shifting your business ahead is to realize you will make mistakes. You know, that failure is okay, but failure and not fixing it is not okay. And so part of success is to keep trying and keep that agility.
Well, and here's another thing, and this could be very important when we think about how companies evolve so quickly, and sometimes mistakes or things like that will be inevitable because of the speed of implementation, is when that broke about the Samsung batteries catching fire, my first thought was to say very much in public, look, I like Samsung laptops. I have 3 Samsung laptops. I've had the Samsung Galaxy Note for as long as I've had smartphones. I've had, on and on, and I'm going to stick with this. This is a long-term brand. This is a reliable brand. The service toward me has always been great. So as far as you tell me to get an iPhone, you get an iPhone. I'm sticking with Samsung. They're my people. So what could you say about what Samsung may have done to build that level of loyalty in me that I'm going to be able to stay with them even when they have their batteries blowing up in their phones?
Well, you know, the first thing they did was, you know, constantly, most of the time, they have the latest technology and their products are pretty much cutting edge. So, you know, if their Galaxy worked like a Nokia, you probably wouldn't be as loyal to it. So the first thing they've done is, you know, have enough R&D and, you know, realizing the technology field, certainly been around a long time, is not a compelling promise to have. But, you know, once they do that, and lots of people are doing that, you know, across the technology category, then it's realizing the customer relationships are long-term and doing whatever it takes to make you happy. Yeah, we had an interesting conversation, speaking of electronics, with Sony, and it used to be, in my generation, Sony owned most of the toys in your home, from the TV set to the sound system, and they were the la-di-da brand in electronics, and then they ran into lots of headwind. And when we spoke to the folks at Sony, you know, part of it is they lost the original mission of Sony. And the original mission when the guy started Sony many years ago was they wanted to make products that gave people, and they had a Japanese phrase for it, but they wanted to give people goosebumps. So when you actually saw their products and felt them and used them, you go, wow. And that's way back when to the Sony Walkman, when you first put on those headphones and could hear music coming out of a little black box like they said, wow. And same with the original Sony television sets. You know, you'd look at the picture and go, oh, my goodness, wow, I'm getting goosebumps. And then they started to make lots of other products, from shower radios to all sorts of things that didn't give people goosebumps. And now as they try to get their company back on track, they're trying to go back to making sure that when they make a product, it will give some consumer goosebumps. So that's when you look at PlayStation and the VR glasses, and they're starting to get focus back to anything they put their name on is going to need to give that consumer a feeling of wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's very true. Now, we're actually coming up towards the top of this. We have 10 minutes left, and I do want to give you a minute or so at the end because I know you wanted to share your book with us or something along those lines. I think you may surprise us. I don't know. But within an organization that needs a shift, who within the organization, in your experience, is best positioned to lead that shift? Is it somebody in the C-suite? Is this an outside consultant? Who should we be looking to lead the shift?
You know, I think that it's a great question, Adam. You know, and it varies, but in general, the companies that do the best job of shifting is when everyone feels it's their responsibility suggest change and to recommend change.
Right.
So there are two things that happen in that. One is that everyone feels the need and to change. Everyone feels confident and open to share it. The other thing that is important in that who should lead it, and companies that tend to have hire people that have different backgrounds and come from different parts of life, because if everyone drinks the same Kool-Aid, as I said, and everyone went to the same high school and everyone went to the same prom and everyone went to the same, goes to the same McDonald's, you know, and then a problem comes up, they're all going to look at that problem the same way. And so companies that tend to have people that look at the same thing but see slightly different things tend to be better at shifting. Don't wait for your boss to say, you know, it's not my job to figure it out. You know, everyone in the company needs to be worried that tomorrow they may wake up and no one's going to want their product anymore.
Yeah. And that's a scary thing to think about, that that shift could happen, because, you know, it's funny you mentioned Sony. I haven't heard anybody mention Sony for a while, and you used to hear about Sony all the time.
Yep.
Now, I mean, there's still out there, but
if you hang out with some gamers, you know, between Xbox and Sony, PlayStation, you know, but you're right. They were the Apple of their day, or they were the Samsung of their day. They're not.
Right. Depending on what you look at, yeah.
Right. And sort of tied to that is this other notion that companies that have trouble shifting ahead sort of have tomorrow as an agenda. They'll say, well, we'll plan for next year on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And, of course, Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock comes and, you know, something else happens. Oh, we'll put it off till next week. And so if you have an attitude, we'll worry about tomorrow, and lots of people, it's really easy to have that. But if you have that attitude of saying, well, tomorrow's tomorrow, we'll worry about it tomorrow, those organizations, big and small, often get into trouble.
Yeah.
There was a famous quote from Andy Grove, I think, of the former CEO of Intel, saying, you know, only the paranoid survive. And that's maybe a bit harsh, but you have to, you know, you can't get arrogant, you can't get cocky, you can't say, oh, we're great, don't worry about it. And you have to always have a bit of humbleness and a bit of concern, saying, gee, you know, what happens if I open the doors tomorrow and there's not a line in front? What are we going to do?
Right.
There will come a day when people won't want our milkshake anymore.
Right. All right. So we have a few minutes left here. Let's shift toward you a little bit, Alan, if we can. And
mm-hmm.
let's speak just a little bit about your own organization so you can share a little bit. What do you do to shift ahead in your own consultancy, which is called Metaphors?
So building off a lot of the research we did for Shift Ahead, you know, one is that the partners we bring on board all have different backgrounds, and they all come from different ends of the business. So when we look at a client that's a company that's not growing fast enough or a business that's struggling, you know, we have different perspectives. And so we'll look to, you know, what does it look from this angle, from that angle? And because we work as a team, you know, we can sort of look at a problem and say, here, you know, here's a 360-degree view. Here's three perspectives. It's not all, oh, here's the answer. You're going to want to sell it for $5 less. So one dimension is the partners all, you know, bring a different perspective. But the other important dimension is, and we didn't talk about this that much, but the other biggest reason companies successfully shift is that they tend to just execute something brilliantly in the marketplace. You know, no one wins because they had a good idea. The only way you win is you have a good idea and then you made a great product or a great service. You have to flip from a good idea to doing something and delivering something great. And so what we then do is once we say, all right, the way you're going to grow your business is X or Y, then we work with some really great experts on our team who can, if you need great packaging, do great packaging, or if you need great ads, do great ads, or if you need great social media, do great. So, because the other thing happening in the world of marketing is that everyone claims to do everything. Oh, we do that too, or we do that too. And I think,
oh yeah,
You know, it's like if you're building a house, yeah, you could have one person build your whole house, and maybe that person will do a pretty good job. But if you're lucky and you're building a house, you'll have, you know, maybe one person do the design, and another person do the plumbing, and another person do the electric, because you wouldn't want your electrician doing your plumbing, and you wouldn't want your
That's
kitchen
true.
Person doing the living room. and you wouldn't want your plumber installing your television set in the living room. And business is like that too. So part of success is to figure out what you need and then try to get the right experts who are really good at what they do but not great at everything or not average at everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about that. So, I just, think about this whole thing, and I've seen so many companies that just fail to make these shifts, and I feel so sorry for them. I mean, one example would be Kodak. I mean, hell, I remember not even 20 years ago, disposable cameras, and I remember you took some pictures from last night, and you still have four exposures, so you go take pictures of squirrels so you can get it developed today. I mean, and companies fail to think ahead that way. I remember Blockbuster Video used to go there and rent DVDs all the time, and now we don't even think of.
Blockbuster could have been Netflix. They
literally
were in the movie distribution business, and they just didn't think it was important. You know, if you remember back, Netflix didn't start sending you movies on your computer. They started mailing you DVDs, so you didn't have to go to the lineup at the Blockbuster. You could be sure Saturday night, if Netflix mails you a DVD, when you get to the Saturday night, you'd have the movie you want to watch. And oftentimes, you went to a Blockbuster, and by the time you got there, the movie you wanted was long gone, and you ended up with Three Mice on an Island or something, some movie you never heard of.
Yeah, and then you see, I think one step further. I mean, in this day and age, you don't even think too much about DVDs. Amazon Prime, Netflix, and then the info product business. I can't remember the last time somebody sold a course where you even had the option to get DVDs. I mean, I know there's still fulfillment companies out there. I know it still exists. But everybody I deal with long since stopped printing DVDs and put it all on membership sites.
Yep. Exactly. So, and again, Netflix didn't think of their business as mainly distributing content. They said, well, gee, people are coming to us for great content. Why don't we make our own great content? And so they were smart enough and lucky enough to be able to then not just wait for Universal or 20th Century Fox to make a movie. They said, we have money. Let's go hire a great writer and director, and we'll make our own movies.
Absolutely. All right, so we are pretty much the top of the hour. We have about 2.5 minutes left, and I want to give one of those to you. Alan, somebody wants to go the next level with you. Somebody wants to discover more about the shift ahead principle.